Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast, and ours too. I'm TJ, the, how to put into words, the multifaceted identity that I occupy, but for the moment, we'll just say that I'm a Pisces. That feels like enough. I think that by this point, the listeners know what that entails, so. And I'm joined today by...
And I'm Aaron.
Who is a...
Person...
I think that's up for debate. As viewer, as
a darn good boyfriend.
Well, that part is less debatable. But he is my very beloved co-host in Aries, with all that that entails. So, since I am, as I alluded to, a Pisces, rather melancholic, rather emotional and overwrought, melodramatic even, it seems appropriate that today we would be talking about Interview with a Vampire. Obviously, there's the new remake on AMC, which we'll be discussing in a later episode, but for today, we're going to be talking about the 1990s version, which I think was pretty pivotal to many queer youths of the time. So, if you haven't seen it, it is told from the point of view of Louis Dupont du Lac, who was played by Brad Pitt, who is relating to Daniel Malloy, played by Christian Slater, his induction into the world of vampirdom by Lestat, played by Tom Cruise. And they are eventually joined by their vampire progeny, Claudia, played by Kirsten Dunst. And it's all about... And then they are, in turn, joined by Antonio Banderas, who plays the vampire Armand in Paris. So that's a pretty brief summary, but it gives you a general sense of what we're dealing with. So I guess we could start out by saying, why this film?
Because of all of the long hair in the movie. I think that's the reason it ended up on our radar.
There is an awful lot of long hair.
There is some really great, fantastic long hair in this movie.
And I mean, I have to say that it would be easy to say the wigs are terrible, but they're actually not. I mean, they're pretty convincing, all things considered. Like, I mean, it's nice to see Brad Pitt with long, flowing brown locks. It's very strange to see Tom Cruise with blonde hair. Maybe the only time in his entire career I've ever seen him with blonde hair. And then, of course, nobody beats Antonio Banderas with...
You watch it for Antonio Banderas' wig. That's if you don't have any other reason to watch this movie, watch for that reason.
And if you are familiar with What We Do in the Shadows, the very funny comedy from FX, like Guillermo, the familiar of the vampire coven, alludes to Interview being key to his identity as like a young queer person, and he particularly loves Armand.
Yes.
And I mean, I, too, love Antonio Banderas as Armand, although he's not at all what the book version of Armand is, but we should get to
that.
But
he's obviously inspiration for Nandor.
Yes, but this is not the episode about What We Do in the Shadows.
True. I'll get back on topic.
So other than the hair, what is it that drew us to this particular film?
Well, I think you already hinted at it. I mean, for lots of gay men and other queer folks, this movie was a much anticipated adaptation of Anne Rice's novel. And that book series was already super popular among the younger gay set, and I guess, suppose, the older gay set, too. But for those of us who were, you know, in our teens, like as I was when this movie came out, it was very much on my must-see list.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about in this film, and its appeal to queer audiences, and part of it is, as you say, the appeal of the original novel, which was published in 1976 by Anne Rice. The queerness is pretty much right there in your face.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I hear people talk about this film, particularly in light of the new version, which is so much more explicit in its queerness, because we see them actually making out, one of the things that strikes, you know, they talk about this film, the 94 version, as being like subtext, so, like there's a lot of queer subtext, but having just watched it the night before last, I'm like...
It's technically subtext.
It is technically subtext in the sense that they don't actually say, hey, dude, I'm in love with you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the kind of subtext that... is so textual that it can't...
It's still... We said subtext, not subtle.
Right.
We just said subtext.
It does not put the sub... It does not put the sub... It's subtle in subtext, I'll tell you that much. So, maybe we could be specific about what we mean about the subtext. Because, I mean, obviously, this movie was made for mainstream audiences. It wasn't... And I don't think it was particularly marketed toward a queer audience per se. I mean, I'm sure that they were aware of the following, but
it would have been way too big budget for that.
Exactly. And it stars two of the biggest stars in Hollywood at the time, and since, to some degree. So it would make sense that straight audiences probably wouldn't have been in on it. I don't think. I don't know.
I don't know. It seems so obvious that I think even straight Harvey, it just must have been.
It's difficult to keep a straight face sometimes, but it's, I mean, it's very clear even from the moment that we are introduced to Lestat and Louis, when Lestat, you know, basically just sweeps Louis off of his mm-hmm. feet, literally speaking.
Yes.
That we're going to see what is functionally a queer romance. Mm-hmm. Like, and a part of it is just that there's a really powerful and I think surprising chemistry between Brad Pitt and mm-hmm. Tom Cruise, given the extent to which these two, you know, are really kind of butting up against each other. Their star texts are kind of like butting up against each other. Mm-hmm. So it's just there's a really potent physicality to their bond that I think really comes out.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of buttoned up against something in this movie.
That is definitely true.
No, but also, because the movie, of course, draws on the very long-standing trope of vampires and the sensuality that we associate with them for so long, the fact that this is going to be a bunch of guys in the movie means that it's going to have to veer into the homoerotic. You know, right. Even without the source material doing that already, just because it's about vampires,
right.
It was going to have to do that anyway.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that you have here two kind of streams coming together, creating a really potent, heady brew. Clearly, I'm a little bit overwrought in my vocabulary. But given what we're talking about Interview, and given Anne Rice's own prose tendencies...
You're speaking the way she writes.
Let us just say, as I'll get to later in the pod, Anne Rice had a profound impact on me. In so many ways.
Yes.
In particular, this movie, which I do think that... This movie captures the queerness of both, you know, the sort of ethos of Anne Rice's novel, but also in terms of, like, it's just a very overwrought movie. Like, everything about it is just delightfully purple prose-ish. Mm-hmm. Everything from Brad Pitt's very mannered acting. Like, at this stage in his career, he is a very mannered actor. Mm-hmm. Like, he tends to over-enunciate, because you could tell he's being a very serious actor.
Well, he's getting rid of his Southern Missouri accent. So.
Right, yes. Which, you know, I mean... One would think that he might have been able to retain that, given that Louis is himself Southern, but...
Well, Southern Missouri.
I don't know what Southern... Well, enlighten us. What does Southern Missouri sound like?
Not quite the South, but...
It's kind of like Southern West Virginia.
A bit like that, yes.
Okay, so that makes sense. But anyway, so it's there in the sort of belabored way that Louis gives his testimony to Daniel throughout the film. Like, his narration is always intruding and is as... overwrought. I mean, that's really the only way I can describe it, as it is in the novel, too. Mm-hmm. And it's there, the queerness there is, though, in, like, the way that Tom Cruise's with Lestat is always kind of bursting at the seams, like, mm-hmm. he's filled with feelings mm-hmm. and arrogance and cruelty. Yes. I mean, not saying that all queers are arrogant and cruel, mm-hmm. but if the suede shoe fits, you know, mm-hmm. where... But I think that's part of where the queerness comes in at a formal level in mm-hmm. the film, as well as obviously its diegetic mm-hmm. concerns.
And he also, Tom Cruise as Lestat also, of course, plays on his looks. Mm-hmm. He knows what he looks like, much like the actor Tom Cruise, and just sort of knows what he looks like, and he plays with that as well. It's a big part of how he pulls in pretty much everyone he interacts with.
Right.
He's constantly, you know, sort of reveling in the fact that he's an attractive man, and so when you're doing that with other men... Of course, that's how it's going to read on screen, is a bunch of queer stuff.
Right. And it also does, you know, the fact that it begins in 18th century Louisiana with, you know, the quasi Gone with the Wind mm-hmm. accoutrements and props and costumes all lends itself to a very, very, not camp. I don't think it's camp, but it is very queer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that some people might read it as camp now mm-hmm. since it's, you know, almost 30 years old, but... That's part of, I think, the queer aesthetic of the film is its setting.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And it's also, I mean, just to get, you know, I want to just speak for a moment about the cast, because I think that that also contributes to the film's queerness. Like, you know, we're talking 94, so at this point, both Cruise and Pitt are two of the biggest stars in Hollywood. But they're also two of the most beautiful stars. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not just that they're handsome. They're strikingly beautiful.
Yes.
And only rarely has Hollywood ever produced two stars who are quite as physically stunning as Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise.
And it's also interesting for me thinking about the kind of, you know, sort of masculine beauty that both of those men mm-hmm. have in real life, and how that's played with and subverted in the movie because they're styled so differently from the way that we're used to seeing them in movies. Right. And of course, again, they're both actors who have, of course, they're good actors, but they've also, especially when they were younger, also traded on their looks a lot because they're both very attractive men.
See also Brad Pitt and Thelma and Louise.
Yes. But, you know, they had that sort of normatively masculine look to them, which of course we throw out the window with Interview with the Vampire. You know, with Brad Pitt doing his best Kirstie Alley impression throughout the whole movie. And
I just need to pause and say that that is possibly the perfect way to describe what I've always sensed about Brad Pitt's performance.
Yes.
So I'm really glad that you put it that way, because that finally makes it make sense to me.
Yes, I mean, it's like the entire time I'm like, is he just sort of channeling Kirstie Alley through this? But that's a whole nother point. And likewise, with Tom Cruise as Lestat, you know, a very different look. Of course, he's blonde, like you've mentioned here, which is very different from Tom Cruise's natural look. But with the long hair, he's basically pulling off the look that the older Hansen brother tried to pull off years later.
Mm-hmm.
But it works for Lestat.
Right.
But again, it gives both Lestat and Louis this very sort of fey look, very a style that we generally don't associate with those two actors. But it still reads on screen as very beautiful, but of a different kind of beauty, I think, than what we're used to seeing with them.
Right, which, I mean, it's worth pointing out that, like, Anne Rice herself was deeply antagonistic to Lestat's casting at first.
Mm-hmm.
But then once she saw it, she's like, oh, you're right, Tom Cruise is actually quite perfectly cast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really striking to me that we have here two, you know, Tom Cruise is an action star at this point. Like, mm-hmm. throughout the 80s, is largely identified with action. Brad Pitt, less so, but more like, you know, prestige dramas, I suppose.
And don't deny his starring role in his one episode of Growing Pains.
But my point being that, like, these are both roles. I mean, if anything, Brad Pitt's casting makes more sense on its surface, just because he's...
Mm-hmm.
This seems like the kind of role he would fit into more easily. Less so for Tom Cruise. But, but somehow, they work even though they shouldn't.
Yes.
Like, that's what always strikes me about this. And I think that it's their beauty and their... the way that they capture something about Anne Rice's vampires that makes them so appealing to queerness. Like, and also, the film itself is of a piece with the early 90s, like, fascination with gothic horror, like looking at Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yes. No, like, interview there.
You know, so it's all very much of a piece and, you know, a kind of a glorious period for the queers who love vampires.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And before we turn away from this to talk about other stuff, I still just want to give one more bit of kudos to Tom Cruise and his performance for this. Because the other thing that he does that I think so well throughout this performance is throughout his turn as Lestat, he's got this almost crazed look in his eye that just stays consistent from the very first time we see Lestat all the way up until his final moment. There is this just slightly manic, and it's very slight, it's a subtle thing, but almost manic look to his face that sort of, for me, does this great job of conveying this sort of restlessness that Lestat has for having been around so long.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of bored, there's nothing else for him to do, that's why he wants Louis, that's why ultimately he's even willing to deal with Claudia,
right?
Because he's just kind of, he doesn't have anything else, because he's never gonna die, he's gonna be around forever. You get bored, I suppose.
Right.
And you just kind of want something, and he does. He carries that in his eyes
right
throughout the performance.
Yeah, and I mean, to take it on the other direction, I do think also that Brad Pitt, there's something really soulful and melancholic and melodramatic about his performance of Louis. And I mention that because all those things are obviously queer-coded within Hollywood, like,
yes,
and within, obviously, Rice's original text. But there's just something, and it's there from the very moment that we meet him, when he appears in his dapper suit in the 20th century with his ponytail, his, you know, that jawline that could, like, cut a diamond, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But he also captures so much of what makes Louis that sad young man, to use a term that Richard Dyer, the queer film theorist, has written about extensively, you know, someone who's kind of out of time, like, in the sense that he's temporally dislocated.
Yeah.
Because he's obviously been alive for 200 some odd years by the time the novel and the movie begins. And he's also just someone who's just really, really self, he's just a Pisces. That's really what it comes out to. Like, he is the epitome of a Piscean.
Yes.
Very woe is me. Yes. Oh, I'm so self-tortured. Oh, I'm so unhappy about being a vampire. Oh, I had to feel so bad about taking human life.
Yeah, everything is just so wrought. I mean, to the point where... How many houses does he burn down in this movie?
Well, I mean, at least two. Well, actually, arguably three if you count the townhouse.
Yeah, because he just sort of, like, he has his little hissy fits and he goes and burns the place down.
Right, which is a very... I mean, that's more of a Scorpio thing than a Pisces thing. But I take your point. But anyway, all of which, I mean, is very, again, queer-coded, and I think a real reason that queers are drawn to this. Because a film like Interview, because of its source material, because of the early 90s, because of the gothic that was so popular, can really just lean into the emotions, can lean into the kind of abandonment to excess that is always very, I mean, I don't want to speak for all queers, but it's very appealing to queer audiences. And obviously there's the male beauty. We've talked extensively about Pitt and Cruz, but also Banderas, like, who is very strikingly handsome. And, you know, he's just putting his toe on the line of chewing the scenery in this movie. But I think captures something interesting about the character of Armand, or Armand, if you're Christine Baranski from The Birdcage, you know, who longs for Louis in much the same way that Lestat did, but in an arguably more emotionally mature way than Lestat did. And then, of course, there's Christian Slater. Yeah. I was going to say, you're going to correct me that I didn't mention Christian Slater.
Yeah, yet. And I'm just kind of like the true hottie of the movie. I don't care what anyone else said. Christian Slater was the one I was lusting after when I saw this movie as a teenager.
He is quite a cutie in this movie, I will say. I mean, he's always cute, but he is extremely cute. And that very specifically 90s way of boys being cute.
Yes.
Like, he has a very 90s look to him with the floppish hair and all that stuff. But you mentioned a few minutes Claudia, and I want to talk about Claudia because there's a lot of really interesting stuff. Obviously, you know, part of the film's homoeroticism comes from the way that Lestat and Louis have that bond with each other. Like, get really close to making out. And basically, I mean, do make out in a very deflected way since, you know, Lestat feeds on Louis. Like, so that's that. But it's with Claudia, arguably, that, like, another nexus of queerness emerges, both in terms of her character itself, but also the role she plays in the narrative. So, you know, in terms of her character, if you haven't seen the film, she's roughly, what, 9, I think?
Yeah, I think that's what they did with her.
Diegetically. In the book, she's 5. Oh, yeah. But in the novel, or sorry, in the movie version, she's a little bit older. And I have to say, of all the characters in this film, I think that Kirsten Dunst is the best cast in terms of who I would have imagined from the book, just because she so perfectly captures the crisis of Claudia's identity. Because obviously, she's a child vampire. So I'm going to put on my academic film critic hat for a moment, so you'll forgive me. So in academia, within queer studies, in the last decade or so, there's been a concept called the queer child sort of articulated, and the idea that the queer child as a literary figure or, you know, film figure is a character that refuses to grow up or refuses to sort of obey the rules of, you know, heteronormative time of growing up, of having children, of getting a job and all that stuff. Obviously, by her very nature, Claudia can't do that. Like, she is bound to forever be a 9-year-old child.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating and horrifying and compelling all at once. And it's true in the novel, too, but it's really horrifying in the movie. Like, I think Kirsten Dunst brings out so much of what's fascinating and queer and terrifying about Claudia. Yeah.
But also, I think it's interesting that, you know, alongside of that sort of horrific idea of never being able to grow up, there's something oddly sort of romantic, and by that I mean romantic era, type thing about sort of like letting the child just sort of be a child. Because since she will forever be a child, without the pressure of growing up, sort of like the child, the sort of the genius of child that gets to be realized there. And I actually wonder what, like, what people would think today of this idea, where it seems like we've, again, have extended childhood again. And I wonder, unlike how it was for those of us who were kids in the 80s and 90s, where it was like, grow up right away.
Right.
With Claudia, it's, no, stay a child whether you want to or not. You're kind of stuck with that. And given how we think about childhood and youth today, I wonder if for a new audience, that would actually feel different.
That's a good question. Maybe. And I mean, because Claudia's sort of crisis, her existential crisis, quite literally, is that her mind advances, and so she matures, but her body does not, and can never. And can't, not only can it not age, it can't change. And one of the most, like, viscerally disturbing moments in the movie is when she decides to cut her hair, because she's like, how dare you make me into this thing? Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to assert myself. And so she cuts her hair. Unfortunately, in Anne Rice's vampire mythos, vampires always have the same length of hair they had when they were born or made into a vampire. Mm-hmm. So immediately her hair grows back, and then we see her screaming in the mirror as the hair grows back. Yeah. And it's really quite a striking moment.
Yeah.
And filled with, like, you can feel her just abject terror of what's happened, because she realizes that she will truly never, ever change.
Yep. Which is weird, though, that they invoke that idea of never changing, because the curls in her hair form at her moment of death.
Right.
That's the thing that always struck me as a little bit odd about how they decided to do that in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. I'm glad they did that with her hair, because that's part of, like, it's part of what makes this character so perfectly captured. Mm-hmm. Like, is the curls. Like, yeah. That to me is, like, makes the film worth the price of admission.
That's why I just kind of wish they had just started her off with that rather than having her hair curl when she turns into a vampire.
Right.
And then go with the idea that from that moment you can't change because they have to change her.
Right.
Into something, then she can't change her.
Yeah, I mean, but it would be hard to have captured those curls exactly when she's, like, a dirty little peasant girl who's in a plague-ridden shack. Like, which is where she is when Louis finds her and decides to... He feeds on her, not with the intention of making her into a vampire. It's Lestat's decision that does that. And then, you know, obviously, so Claudia can never grow up and is truly furious with her fathers. And that's, I think, another point where the queerness comes out, which is really interesting because we have here basically a queer family. Like, two men raising a daughter together.
Yes.
Which is a really...
the child that they created together.
Right, exactly. Because, I mean, that is the thing. Like, it was truly a joint effort. She would never have been made a vampire if Louis hadn't been feeding on her. Mm-hmm. And then Lestat saw her and made fun of him and then, you know, decided to give her the blood. And in many ways, Claudia is a perfect combination of their two personality traits. Like, she has all of Louis' sort of introspection, much to her chagrin, but all of Lestat's cruelty and, like, his killer instinct. Like, she has no compunction about killing people. And I think some of the film's best scenes are those in which Claudia is shown killing adults who are deceived by her childlike appearance.
Yep, exactly. And she gets to revel in that, like, it's not just, I get to kill so I can feed. It's like, I get to have the fun of playing this trick.
Mm-hmm. And there's, I think, one of the most interesting scenes is where she looks at a woman in a store window, and she wants to be her, which is a really rich moment. Like, it's one of those moments that makes this film really fascinating and not just, you know, cheap thrill. Because she's like, I want to be her. She doesn't want to eat her. She wants to be her, which is this fascinating reflection on the way that cinema itself works. Like, and how we look at sort of our cinematic counterparts and we want to be the stars that we see on the screen. It's just a really fascinating moment, but it's also the one of those key incidents when she realizes that that can never be, and her hatred for Lestat in particular continues to grow. And so, you know, it strikes me also that, you know, the year 1994 in particular was a big one for fathers raising children together, because that's also the same year of The Lion King, where we have Timon and Pumbaa raising Simba. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's a lot of gayness going on in the 90s. It's no wonder so many of us turned out queer. But the other thing that strikes me about Claudia is that she also kind of functions as the sort of node in the homosocial triangle. Again, I'm going to put on my academic hat. Mm-hmm. So in the writings of Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick, a very noted queer theorist from the 90s, like, she argues that a lot of times in Western literature and culture, men will articulate their feelings of desire or feeling for one another through a female figure. It's why the love triangle is such a predominant part of the literary tradition. And I don't want to say, obviously, that Lestat or Louis have erotic feelings for Claudia, because that's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that she provides each of them a way of sort of, like, getting across the feelings for one another that they can't quite bring themselves to express.
Yeah.
Because for Lestat, the whole reason he makes Claudia is to trap Louis and with him. Like, he makes sure that Louis is bound to him through this creation. Mm-hmm. And for Louis, he feels the loyalty to Claudia and doesn't want to, like, disrupt what they've, this thin, fragile piece that they've managed to construct.
Yeah. And for me, I read her a little bit differently, mainly because she Claudia functions as the child to the basically partnered Louis and Lestat. I actually read her a little bit differently. I wouldn't use that homosocial frame that Sedgwick used, because that works better, I think, for female characters who are a supposed romantic interest for at least one of the men that we're talking about, or failing that, at least sort of like adult friendships, mm-hmm. where those things happen, because she bonds these two together as basically as husbands.
Right.
We don't need that extra layer, I think, to get at the queer aspect of their relationship.
Okay. I mean, I will. I'm not absolutely wedded to this idea of Claudia as the node in the homosocial triangle. But I do find it really interesting that she's also, while she is obviously the agent that glues them together, she's ultimately the one that splits them apart, because mm-hmm. she's the one who leads the coup against Lestat and, like, poisons him with dead blood and cuts his throat and mm-hmm. has him dump him in the swamp. Obviously, he survives. Mm-hmm. But then they go to Paris, and you get the sense that Louis, without Lestat, Louis feels lost. Mm-hmm. Like, because you sense that there's something that Lestat provided him emotionally, physically, spiritually, maybe. I mean, this is Anne Rice after all. That Claudia just can't.
Yeah.
And it's the tragedy that Claudia can sense that and accepts it much more quickly than Louis himself does. Louis mm-hmm. really struggles against the idea that he can't be with Claudia, or that she can't give him that, which, I mean, you know, she's a child, obviously. Mm-hmm. For all that her mind might advance, like, she's still a child with all of the limitations that imposes. And that's why the introduction of Armand is so important.
And let's face it, Louis wants a man anyway.
That's why this film is so queer, is because it's so clear the only meaningful relationship, adult relationship, Louis can ever have is with a man. Like, mm-hmm. we don't see him showing much erotic interest in women, except for arguably his wife who dies before the movie begins.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an important change, by the way, because in the novel, it's his brother that's died, plunges him into depression. Not a wife and child.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting little change. A little desperate attempt to heterosexualize mm-hmm. Louis.
Gotta butcher him up a bit.
Not very successfully, I might add. So, you know, obviously that's why when they see the Theatre de Vampires in Paris, which is a group of vampires pretending to be humans, pretending to be vampires, mm-hmm. who literally kill people on stage for the entertainment and horror of the... It's Graham Guignol, like, taken to its logical extreme.
It's a nice night of entertainment. What can I say?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to say... It's literally, like, the epitome of Graham Guignol. Like, it's really a quite lovely... what do we want to call it? Self-reflexive moment, mm-hmm. I suppose. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, for Armand, you know, feels himself drawn to Louis in somewhat similar to the way that Lestat did, but... Because I think both of them view Louis as sort of an object. Like, I don't know that either Lestat or Armand really view Louis as a person. They kind of view him, what's the word I'm looking for, in terms of his utility to their own emotions. Mm-hmm. That's my viewpoint about it anyway. Yeah. But it's what ultimately leads Armand to sort of turn a blind eye to the rest of the Theatre of the Vampires, basically condemning Claudia and the new vampire Madeline and Louis all to death. Like, they put Louis in a coffin and wall him up, and then they put poor Claudia and her new vampire mother Madeline into this open area where the sun basically destroys them. It's quite a wrenching moment, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, for me, it's always been one of the most horrifying things is when we watch poor Claudia getting turned into dust.
Yeah, that is the one part of the movie that I remember even watching it back in the day where I was like, oh, this actually feels sad to me, you know, as a teenage boy who didn't admit having feelings.
Right, a teenage boy who didn't admit having feelings. Now the adult who doesn't admit to having feelings.
No, as the adult, I just don't have feelings.
So, anyway, we'll dive into that on another episode. So then, obviously, you know, Louis, in a fit of rage, justifiably, and having been freed by Armand, then torches the entire Theatre de Vampires, except for Armand. And here we come to one of the moments where the film comes closest to actually creating a queer romance. Like, we see Armand and Louis having this confrontation where Louis is basically like, dude, you killed my child, like, mm-hmm. and you want to hang out with me now, like, you want me to engage in this romance with you? I think not. But he gets really close to Armand's face, and you can feel the desire pulsing between them,
mm-hmm.
and then Louis breaks it off and is like, just kidding, no gay dude, like, you know, no homo, I suppose is what they say. And so That was one of those moments where I turned to you and I said, subtext, huh?
And I was like, they didn't actually say it, so...
Right. And so, I mean, there is a sense in which, you know, the film is teasing us in a way that one would expect of an early 90s film that's trying to have mainstream appeal while also talking about vampires who are obviously gay.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, we flash forward to the future and Brad Pitt encounters the tortures of the present. And then he has his, like, final encounter with Lestat. And then the movie begins to end as Daniel is like, make me a vampire. And then Louis flies into a rage and leaves. And then, to top it all off, Daniel is fed on by Lestat. Which I have to say, Lestat has one of my favorite lines in the movie. Because as Daniel is driving, he's listening to the tapes that he's recorded. And then... Lestat says, ugh, Louis, still whining. And I love that moment just because it's such a perfect articulation of everyone who's ever read Interview with the Vampire. Like, oh my God, Louis, why are you whining so much? It's a perfect way to end the movie, I think, to give Lestat the last word. Mm-hmm. And very much in keeping with Anne Rice's own creation. Like, she created Lestat without really knowing what he was going to become.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's only fitting that he should be the one to get to dominate the story at the end.
Yeah.
So, what other queer stuff do we have to talk about in this show, in this movie?
I don't know. I think we covered a lot of stuff, and I'm sure our listeners will think of more things because it is an Anne Rice novel turned into a movie.
Right, so, I mean,
we could probably do this forever, talking about queer stuff.
But I do want to, one last thing I do want to talk about, and we alluded to this a little bit in the pregame, is the juxtaposition of this with its successor. Like, because, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it's really interesting to me that 20 years on, give or take, you know, we're getting a new adaptation of the story that is more explicitly queer, and which we'll talk about this in more detail when we get to the actual episode.
Wait, you're saying there's an updated version of Interview with the Vampire?
There is.
Really?
Don't act so innocent. You've seen the show as much as I have. You know, so, I mean, I think that it's interesting. That's part of the reason I wanted to do this episode, was to sort of reflect on what Interview with the Vampire 1994 can offer us today. Like, as you know, because obviously we live in an age in which it's much more common for queerness to be explicitly represented. So I think it's worth maybe asking, like, what is it that this version gives us, not aside from the nostalgia value, mm-hmm. like, what is it that is still very potent and seductive about this film?
And I think that there's going to be something to it, which we've talked about this in other things that we've discussed for the podcast. But when you go back in time to when things were sort of less open, so not only in the historical time period in which Interview with the Vampire is set, but also the early 90s when the movie was released, you know, things weren't quite as open. It was riskier to do that. So things had to be coded in some ways. Things had to be more subtle. And I actually think that there's a lot of creative potential
mm-hmm.
in terms of how you depict things like intimate feelings and love and all that kind of stuff when you can't just come right out and say it.
Right.
It's like when that choice is foreclosed, it forces you to think more creatively.
Mm-hmm.
about how to do that kind of stuff. And I think that that's a real benefit to this movie and some of the other ones that we've talked about in the past, like when we did Morris
mm-hmm.
and some other things that we've talked about where one thing that repression does is that it does make for good art.
That's true.
It makes for pretty shitty living conditions, but it makes for interesting art.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, and I will be honest that I do really love this new version, but I love it distinctly from this. Like, I have had to sort of do some mental gymnastics where I've divorced the two things. Like, I've mm-hmm. cleaved them apart because I don't want to privilege one or the other because I think they work very differently. And I think that maybe part of the reason that this version, as you say, is so compelling is because the desire is allowed to sort of percolate under the surface mm-hmm. and yet on the surface too. Like, that's why I think it's such a rich and complicated and fascinating film, is because we sense this love and desire between Lestat and Louis, but we hardly ever actually see it consummated.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we live in an era of wanting things to be consummated. And I'm as guilty of this as many other film viewers. Like, we want to see queerness brought to its fruition. Like, we're tired mm-hmm. of being, because we've had so many decades of queer baiting. But I mean, arguably, Interview is queer baiting, but in some ways it's not. It's staying true to the gothic nature of the novel. Like, I mean, if you look at gothic as a tradition, like, it's all about sublimated desires. Like, they're always kind of lurking under the surface and threatening to burst out at any moment. And so I think that that's one of the things that I still find very appealing about this movie, especially, you know, if you were a young queer person in the 90s, in the closet, presumably. Like, there's something really powerful about the idea of queer vampires who themselves have to live closeted lives, both in terms of, like, living in coffins, but also in terms of, like, they can't reveal their existence or else they'll literally be killed. And, you know, that's why the theater to vampires has such a, you know, a bite to it, if you'll forgive them. The pun is because they live openly right under the noses of the people who don't even realize that that's what they're doing.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that there's still a lot that a film like Interview can still provide for us. And I mean, I just wanted to wax poetic for a moment about the joy of watching early 90s movies back when things were still filmed on sets. Like actual, I mean, sometimes it looks a little stagey, like you can tell that it's a film set. But to me, at least, there's something really pleasurable about remembering the days when Hollywood wasn't all just green screen.
Exactly, yes. And when we have actual built sets. You know, some of it, I'm like, would have been nice to, I would say, to be on location rather than on a built set. There were times when I was expecting Vanessa Williams to come out and start singing halfway through the movie because it looked more like a music video. Specifically one of her music videos from the era. But overall, I agree with you. There's something live to actually being on a set that you can't really replicate using green screen, because there can't be a real relationship between foreground and background and that kind of stuff that you don't have to worry about here. It's like it just feels more authentic to me. It's like the performances can be more authentic, the staging can be more authentic. It just works better for me.
Right, and I mean, I think there's also something just, how do I want to put it? There's something very sincere about this movie. Because, I mean, I think that as a decade, the 90s was very ironic, but also surprisingly sincere. You and I have talked about this before. And I think the Interview is one of those movies that could so easily lend itself to camp. And I'm sure maybe today's younger viewers would view it through the lens of camp. I don't know. I don't really care. But there's something really, it just takes itself so seriously. And I kind of love that about it. I mean, because that's true of Anne Rice's novels, too. Like, if you've ever read The Vampire Chronicles, you know that they're very serious and very weighty. And I think that the film manages to capture that. That's not to say that there aren't moments of levity in this movie, because there are. Obviously, with the character of Santiago, played by Stephen Ray, very famous for being in the crying Game, also directed by the same person who did this movie. So, you know, there is that sense, like, that there is a bit of play as well that sort of helps to leaven the melodrama at times.
Yeah, but for me, the thing that makes it, this movie campy is with the stuff that you say makes it not. It's like that the movie sort of does take itself seriously is for me what makes it so campy. It's that it's not like holding itself up and saying, look at me, I'm making a joke right now. It's not doing that. It's actually being earnest in what it's doing, which for me is what makes it so campy.
So, can you, I mean, I guess I would want to, like, I think I see what you're saying, but there's always that part of me, despite the queer in me, I always kind of rebel against camp. Because to me, when you read something as camp, it feels like you're invalidating whatever seriousness is there. And I know that's not really the point, but that's I have this kind of impulse to defend things against camp. Because camp is so often used to dismiss things. So that would be my rejoinder as such to that.
Yeah. And for me, I'm just kind of like, that's great, but it's like I said, for me, what makes it campy is that in order for something to be camp, it can't be so in on the joke. If you see a joke there, it can't be in on it. It actually needs to be kind of sincere. Because if it's in on the joke, it's holding itself at a kind of critical distance that I don't think camp really allows for. It's like with camp, it's like you wholeheartedly embrace whatever it is you are, and you just do it.
So, okay, so I'm glad you brought this up, because I think this is really a really important discussion to have about Interview in particular. So do you think that queer audiences of the time, say adult audiences, not melodramatic teenagers, let me put it that way, do you think queer audiences of the time would have read it through the lens of camp, Or would they have taken it seriously, or both?
I'd say it depends on their reading of Sontag, frankly.
Okay.
Because it depends on the role of seriousness in camp for you. I think that's the difference. As for some of us, camp requires some degree of, like, seriousness. Like, in order for something to read as camp, it actually has to be somewhat, it has to be treated as genuine. Right. In some way.
I mean, it has to, like, yeah, I mean, that's, I guess this is a larger conversation. And I mean, I guess I can see what you mean. Like, there is something distinctly campy, even from a 90s, early 90s perspective about Brad Pitt's over enunciation mm-hmm. or Tom Cruise's wig mm-hmm. and the frock coats.
Yes.
Arguably the least campy element is, or, you know, as we said, Antonio Banderas's wig. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I guess I'm just so deeply conflicted about camp as a phenomenon, as a cultural phenomenon, that while I love it, I also hate it when it's applied to the things that I love and take seriously. That's what I guess I'm getting at.
Yeah. Whereas for me, I love it for the stuff that, when it's associated with stuff that I enjoy, because for me, camp is, honestly, it's a celebration to me. It's like, because it's, I think of basically every performance given by someone like Jennifer Coolidge is campy.
Right.
And it's because she's so absolutely committed to those performances is what makes them campy, as opposed to just bad acting.
Right. Yeah, I guess so. The final question I would have, and I don't want to belabor this subject, but I think it's an important one for how we think of my larger question of what we make of Interview today. Like, if we view it through the lens of camp, whether that's queer camp, whether that's sort of historical camp, which is just that things that are old feel different, because mm-hmm. now we're to the point where, like, 20 years is enough for things to have entered that realm, because mm-hmm. the acting and the performances and the sets and all that feels different than a movie made today. It feels different than the series made today. Mm-hmm. The question that I have is, like, what does reading it as camp give us? Like, what right. do you, like, what do you, as someone who does read it that way,
mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe I'm still too close to it to read it as yeah. camp. So I guess my question to you would be, what does reading Interview as Camp give you?
For me, it actually makes it a little bit easier to take it seriously, because rather than sort of dismissing the cheesier elements of the movie, I actually have to take them for what they are.
Okay.
Instead of just looking at it going, oh man, this is just so dated.
Right.
And moving on, I have to go, no, this was an actual sincere rendering of the story.
Right. And I mean, because I think that part of what we would pick up on as being very cheesy, I mean, are the long flowing hair, mm-hmm. all the kind of gothic accoutrement of mm-hmm. both gothic, like, as it's reimagined in the early 90s, but also very specifically romance of the 90s, like, mm-hmm. when I'm talking not just about rim, I'm talking about novels, like, yes. Yeah, the very Fabio-esque.
Exactly, and of course the shots of both of our actors at some point or another looking like Fabio.
Right. So, yes, okay, I think that that's true, and I think that this is what makes Interview even now so fascinating, mm-hmm. and so queer, as yeah. even now, because it has, it can, like, as a palimpsest, it accrues more layers of queerness as the years go by.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's maybe I can make peace with the idea of Interview with the Vampire being camp.
Wow. Now that's progress, folks.
Well, that seems like a good place to conclude after the false lead of a conclusion earlier,
mm-hmm.
before I took us off into a new and exciting direction. So give us just a few moments, and we'll be right back to do a deep cut, where each of us will share a little bit about our own deep experiences with the Anne Rice oeuvre and this movie in particular. Well, welcome back. And, you know, I will not go on about this as long as I could, because I really can't overstate the importance of this movie, but also Anne Rice's oeuvre more generally, to my development as a writer, as a queer person, as just a person, like, I discovered Anne Rice when I was 15, 16. A friend of mine gave me The Mummy, and then I read... So I read the interview... I read the Vampire Chronicles way out of order. Like, I started with Armand, I think, and then I read Lestat, and then I read Interview. Oh,
that explains a lot about your life.
It does explain a great deal about my life, and why I have never taken Louis seriously, because I've always read him through Lestat's perception rather than the other way around. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole essay to be written about that, but I won't go on about that for now. So I read the interview, and then I was finally like, I need to watch the movie version. And boy, did I love that movie. Like, at first, I was a little bit... I did find the Lestat thing a little jarring, but then when I kind of settled into the movie's groove, I was like, oh my God, it was like an awakening. Like, I think it's, you know, these days, you know, with the glut of queer media in books and TV and movies and everything else, it's easy to forget, like, these sort of islands of queerness that those of us who grew up in the late 90s and 2000s, like, this is what we had. Like, mm-hmm. aside from the other kinds of movies we cover here on Queens, like, this is the kind of stuff that, to me, in some ways, like, is even gayer or queerer than a lot of, mm-hmm. like, actual gay stories.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing that struck me about Interview, you know, which comes out roughly at the same time as, like, Philadelphia and other kind of prestige gay dramas. But it's so much queerer,
mm-hmm.
and I think I sensed that even as a teenager,
yeah.
that there's something really potently queer about Interview with the Vampire that really, you know, I don't want to say that Interview is adolescent, but there is something about it in its overwroughtness, in its explicitness, in its, you know, all the weeping and... just everything. Just everything about it. It's perfect balm to the adolescent soul.
Yes.
Especially to the queer adolescent soul. Because let's be real. Us queers are an emotional sort. Like, we're an emotional bunch.
Yeah, that's me.
Well, some of us are emotional. And, you know, if you think I'm a basket case now, you should have seen me when I was 16. When it was even worse. So, you know, I saw in Interview something really that just called to my soul. And it, particularly since I'd already read the books, like, I felt like it was such an accurate conveying of queer desire. Like, and of the particularly, like, contorted version that many young queer people experience. Because, you know, for us, as we've talked about on this pod before, like, at least those of us growing up in the 90s, like, the normal rituals that young heterosexuals go through is very different for us, because we're not permitted to express our feelings in the same way. So this kind of closet narrative of Interview feels like such an authentic expression for us, and it allows us to experience it through the text itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was all the things that I was picking up on. My best friend from high school used to mock me relentlessly, because I think even at the time, so I watched this movie in like 2000. So even by then, it had a reputation for being the gay vampire movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something that, like, my friend was like, why are you watching this gay vampire movie? So, you know, for me, Anne Rice's work in its cinematic adaptations, except for Queen of the Damned, about which we will not speak because it is an abysmal abomination of which the less said, the better. But there was just a lot.
Hallelujah.
I know. Tragic in so many ways. You know, so this film, like, just really spoke to me. And one brief final aside, you'll recall there's a scene in the movie where Lestat has this little thing on his thumb, like, with a spike on it.
Mm-hmm.
Spencer is the store at the mall that, you know, used to sell all those kinds of, like, emo shit,
mm-hmm.
had one of those. And I bought it before I watched Interview, but it seemed it was a weird confluence of forces,
mm-hmm.
and I used to wear it in high school. So that gives you a sense of what kind of...
Yes.
What kind of person...
It was a missing piece of the puzzle.
That gives you a sense of what kind of person I was in high school. And I mean, as the last thing I will say is that during this kind of summer camp for nerds that I went to, in two successive years, I dressed up as the vampire Lestat and as Armand. And let me tell you, I made a hell of a costume in both cases. I'm just saying.
Nice.
Along with a crushed velvet cape and, like, buckle shoes and everything.
I mean, that's how you always dress.
Yes, but it was one of my crowning achievements as a young person was dressing up as a new vampire. So all of which, as I'm saying, is that gay vampires were very key to my upbringing as a queer person. And they taught me how to be gay, which explains a great deal about my life. So, Aaron, what's your deep cut?
See, I'm just going to go in a totally different direction then. Instead of talking about how Anne Rice's work after discovering First Interview, because I, in anticipation of the movie, I went out and got the book. Because I had heard about this gay vampire movie that was coming out. Because that's how it was described to me, even though that's not quite canon for the movie. I went out and sought out the books and discovered this Anne Rice person whose work I had actually never read until, you know, until all of the hype for this movie came out. And of course, you know, reading her other writings made it much more clear to me that I was actually gay. Her more explicit writings give you fodder for that sort of thing. Right. But I'm not going to go there. I'm actually going to talk about something totally different. And that's how, because I read the books in anticipation, or the first book in anticipation of seeing Interview with the Vampire, that's what got me into thinking about the idea of books being adapted for movies. Because I didn't grow up, you know, thinking about this, given what I do for a living, it's probably surprising for a lot of folks, but I was actually surprisingly old before I actually gave any thought to, like, how movies got made from stories. And it was actually through this experience that I actually started to think about that. Obviously, Interview's not the first adaptation I've ever seen, obviously, because there are lots of adaptations. But it's the first one that I ever actually thought about as an adaptation, like actually seeking out the text first and comparing what I saw in the movie to what I saw in the book. And thinking about how much the experience of reading the book enriched the viewing experience. Which was very different from my experience of watching a different adaptation of an Anne Rice book, Exit to Eden.
Oh, boy.
Because it's the same thing with that one. It was like, oh, this is a terrible movie.
Has anyone ever experienced such widely varying adaptations of their work? Maybe Stephen King.
Yes,
the only other example I can think of who's had such widely varying fortunes when it comes to cinematic adaptations.
Yeah, because the Exit to Eden movie almost made me give up on this whole movie thing because it was so bad. But yeah, I can really credit Anne Rice, you know, in the handful of folks who actually influenced the way that I thought about this thing that became a big part of what I do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like it's been a big part of my life ever since. And I really owe a lot of that to Anne Rice.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I have to say that I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is the thing, is that, you know, Anne Rice has a lot of influence upon those of us. I mean, it's really, you know, I spoke in the main segment about how, like, this movie is so peak 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, Anne Rice was, like Stephen King, was one of those people who was literally everywhere.
Yes.
Throughout the 80s and certainly in the 90s. Like, her work was just everywhere. Like, it was, if you went to the, like, even a general store or even a grocery store, like, her work would be there. Which it's hard to imagine someone having, like, someone writing in that tradition and being so explicitly queer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, it was quite exciting, I think. And so, yeah, there's a lot to love about this movie. And I think that, you know, it's worth pointing out, too, that the director, you know, Neil Jordan, I alluded to earlier, like, did The Crying Game, like, 2 years before, obviously, a queer movie.
Spoiler alert.
Well, when we do the episode, we can talk about it. Aaron's making a very funny pun, I'm assuming, on the central revelation in The Crying Game, which was a... We'll get to that. When we do The Crying Game, we'll talk about that in more detail. Anyway, so there is a certain kind of, like, queer sensibility, even though he himself is not queer, but he certainly brings a kind of sensibility to that. And so, you know, the last thing I want to say as we finish up the deep cut is that, you know, when Anne Rice died, what, a year and a half ago, give or take, you know, I really felt keenly that loss. We spoke last week about the, you know, the power of losing queer icons and the feeling that we get.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, for those of us like you, like me, like a lot of other, I mean, I cannot overstate to you how many queer people I know, their gateway drug to, like, queer culture was Anne Rice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was a shared reading and viewing experience for many, many people. Even in my little podunk town of West Virginia, like, I bonded with other queer, young queer folk through Anne Rice. Like, she provided a kind of shared vernacular, for lack of a better word. And, like, she had a fandom. Like, I'm not sure that it's quite as evident now, except maybe it's coming a little bit because of the new interview version. But, you know, lots of people we made little covens, really, through Anne Rice's work.
Yeah.
And I really felt keenly when she died. I know that not everyone liked her because of, you know, her stance about fan fiction, and she was very defensive about her writing. But anyway, I even went to New Orleans once.
Wow.
And saw her where she had lived at one point. I don't want to gush too much more about Anne Rice, but I just wanted to say briefly that, as was the case with, you know, Angela Lansbury, with Leslie Jordan, like, we're losing our queer icons, and I think it's appropriate to memorialize that.
Mm-hmm.
And one last thing, if you have not read the Sleeping Beauty Chronicles, or the Chronicles of Sleeping Beauty, you really should, because that's a great example of the explicitness.
Them books dirty.
They are very dirty, in all the best ways. So, you know, that was also a sort of shared reading experience. So,
mm-hmm. Are you admitting to reading such filth?
Yes, in fact, in band, the queerness continues. We would pass around copies of the Sleeping Beauty novels, which are straight up erotica.
The corruption of our nation's youth.
It all began in the 90s.
Yes.
Such a fascinating decade, the 90s, with, you know, this was the decade that gave us Interview, but also Jerry Falwell and, you know, all those other
Jeffrey
lunatics.
Dahmer. Right. That's when he was released.
Well, there's an odd parallelism between that and eating people and vampirism, but that's far too much for us to address at this exact moment. So suffice it to say that I love Anne Rice. I still love Anne Rice. I don't have quite the sort of undiluted adoration of her that I did as a young person. And, you know, reading the Vampire Chronicles in 2022, one can see, be like, okay, yeah, this is a bit purplish. Even for me, notoriously purple prose-ish, in case you hadn't noticed. But even so, I still, when I watch this movie, when I read her work, I enjoy it both for what it is, but also for this particular period of who I was as a queer person. Like, I mean, I haven't changed that much since I was 16, but it is still nice to sort of go back in time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to hear that, you know, this Anne Rice adaptation made you want to be a filmmaker.
Well, I didn't say that.
Well, close enough. That's my little gloss on what you said. So I think that's a good place to end, since we've really kind of, you know, talked extensively about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So give us a moment and we'll be right back to give you a little bit of where you can find us on social media. All right. Well, thank you everyone for joining us for another fabulous episode of Queens of the Beast. I cannot express how much I've been looking forward to doing this episode. I mean, I love, in case you didn't get the feeling, I love Interview with a Vampire.
He loves Interview with a Vampire.
I do love Interview with a Vampire. So it was really fun to get to talk about it with Aaron, who has given me a lot to think about. I'm more deliberate and I think more systematic way of thinking about this movie's queerness. Like, it's, again, one of those things people say, but we need to drill into why it is queer. So mm-hmm. I appreciate that Aaron was able to do that with me. So, should I even bother asking where I can find you on social media?
I mean, you can always ask.
He did post on Facebook the other day.
Don't tell them.
He did post on Facebook, which was a huge deal because he never does that. But anyway, he doesn't have social media, so don't bother. So if you would like to follow me, however, you can follow me on Twitter at TJ West and the number 3. You can also follow me on Instagram at Thomas West and the number 3. And you can follow our Instagram account at Queens of the Bees. It spells out like Queens of the BS, but we'll just have to deal with it. I couldn't put an apostrophe.
I mean, that's an appropriate name for us.
It is true. We are Queens of the BS. So if you would like to follow us there, we do post bite-sized reviews of the things that we watch. Also, some of the stuff we don't have time to cover on the podcast, we do reviews of. I also hope to be doing some stuff about queer screen history. So there'll be lots to follow on there. So please, especially since Twitter is imploding, you might want to check us out on Instagram. Well, for the foreseeable future, we'll still have a presence. You can also check out my newsletter called Omnivorous over at Substack. I do write about queerness. I've been doing episode reviews of the new Interview with a Vampire, as well as a bunch of other gay shit. So please follow me there and subscribe. I do need those subscribers. Which brings me to the last segment. So please be sure to rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts, particularly Apple Podcasts. I know I've said this before, but it bears repeating. The more ratings and reviews we get, the easier it is for other people to find us. And much as we love all of you are committed 40 or so listeners who listen every week. We do want to continue growing because one day we would like to retire and be able to just do podcasting full time. So in order to do that, we need all of your help to spread the word, tell your friends. If you have other things that you'd like to say to us, then please do. As always, please send your negative comments to Aaron. Give all your praise to me. I will gladly take it all. But we do appreciate everyone who takes the time to give us ratings on iTunes because it really does help to build our visibility and our fan base. So I think that is all at my word vomit. Now that I've spewed it all out at all of you, I will bid you adieu for this week. So for Queens of the Bees, I'm your co-host TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we'll be right back with you next week.